Professor Barton Carter be the speaker for this month's colloquium. Again, this colloquium is part of the Communication Research Colloquium Series that's sponsored by the Communication Research Center. Professor Carter is a professor of communication and law here in the College of Communication, and today he's going to be talking about whether it's time to revise Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and so we're excited to have him. So please join me in welcoming Professor Barton Carter.
Thank you. I am curious how many of you showed up just because you quickly saw the word decency in the title and figured they'd show up. Yeah, Dustin, I assumed in your case. My research interests have always focused on the interaction between communication law and new communication technologies. This encompasses everything from regulation to interpretations of the First Amendment. A couple of quick examples. The 1909 Copyright Act granted protection to all the writings of an author. Well, problems arose fairly quickly because of new technologies. An early case decided that piano rolls were not the writings of an author because you couldn't read a piano roll. Luckily, other courts got a more expansive reading later on and extended the definition to include photographs, drawings, sound recordings, and motion pictures. But it wasn't until the Copyright Act of 1976, almost 70 years later, that Congress actually changed the wording and granted protection to all original works of authorship fixed in a tangible medium of expression now known or later developed from which they could be perceived, reproduced, or otherwise communicated either directly or with the aid of a machine or device. Now, technological changes can also affect First Amendment interpretation. Back in the 70s, the court in Pacifica, a case you may have heard of, involved George Carlin and seven dirty words. I won't bother telling you all seven. Besides, those of you who know them realize it's really only six because one's a competent form of another. In any event, they held that broadcasters could be punished for indecent speech because broadcasting was uniquely pervasive and accessible to children. Today, most children don't know the difference between broadcast and cable channels, and they get most of their media with tablets and smartphones. I have granddaughters, I know. Yet the court has been unwilling to declare Pacifica no longer good law. As a result, broadcasting is still treated differently than other media in that area. Most recently, this is one that's ongoing, and some of you may have heard it in the news, etc. A Massachusetts case involving Michelle Carter, no relation, thank God, is another example. Michelle was a Plainville, Massachusetts high school student who sent her boyfriend a number of texts encouraging him to commit suicide, as well as specific instructions on how to set his truck for carbon monoxide poisoning. Well, there's a girlfriend, let me tell you. She then called him as he was preparing to do it. As the trial judge noted, up to the moment he passed out from the toxic fumes, then 17-year-old Carter was on the telephone with him. She later informed friends. When he had doubts and climbed out of the truck, she ordered him back in. According to the trial judge, she was, quote, virtually there, and thus her instructions to return to the truck constituted wanton and reckless conduct by Ms. Carter, creating a situation where there is a high degree of likelihood that substantial harm would result to Mr. Boyd. She was convicted of manslaughter and is now appealing on the grounds of the First Amendment. Several key questions. Were the text and the call speech or conduct? Was she virtually there? Clearly nothing you would have had in earlier days. As you can see from these examples, courts and legislatures often have trouble dealing with new communication technologies. There are several reasons for this. First, technology moves a lot faster than law. In fact, there are polar opposites in terms of rate of change. Second, those responsible for changing the law may not understand the latest technologies. For example, some justices may still believe broadcasting is uniquely pervasive and accessible to children. Needless to say, the problem has been drastically exacerbated by the internet. The law is simply falling farther and further behind. 10 years ago, I started looking at how internet development, specifically Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, had affected defamation law. A little quick background. Ever since the Supreme Court's decision in Times v. Sullivan, there's been an attempt to balance the state's interest in protecting its citizens' reputation against the First Amendment interest in free and robust debate about public issues. Concern that the chilling effect of defamation law was stifling this speech, the Supreme Court made it more difficult for public officials to win defamation suits by requiring them to prove actual malice. Those of you in my class, I hope, know the term by now. Subsequently, in Gertz versus Robert Welch, this requirement was extended to public figures, and an added requirement of proving negligence was imposed on private individuals. In the early days of the internet, there was concern that defamation law, not to mention indecency law, the original primary concern, and privacy law, would have a different chilling effect, that it would seriously hinder the development and growth of the internet. In 1996, as part of the Communications Decency Act, Congress enacted a safe harbor provision that addressed this problem. Essentially, it granted ISPs, websites, and so on immunity for user-generated content, and also provided that editing such content would not remove that immunity unless the edits themselves created the unlawful nature of the content. In the 22 years following passage of Section 230, the internet has developed into a major communication medium. It is now truly pervasive in our society, having a major impact on business, education, entertainment, social interaction. All you have to do is look at people who can't get their phone out of their hand. Not any of you, of course. However, this has not come without some cost. Section 230 has left numerous victims of harmful internet speech without a remedy. Now, in assessing whether any law is constitutional under the First Amendment, one has to consider not only whether the law regulates speech, but whether the law might deter or chill speech. Thus, the constitutional privilege in libel that originated in Times versus Sullivan was based on the chilling effect that defamation law could have on discussion of public affairs. With the internet, the concern was not of chilling specific content, but rather the development of new services. One of the strengths of the internet is that it allows individuals to communicate with a worldwide audience at minimal cost. However, if the internet service providers and websites that carry these messages could be held legally responsible for the content, there could be a strong incentive to limit those messages. With traditional media, liability for other people's content is determined by distinguishing publishers from distributors. Those who actively choose content, newspapers, broadcasters, and so on, are viewed as publishers and as such liable for that content. So if letter to the editor appears in a newspaper and it's defamatory, the newspaper is liable. Passive distributors, such as news vendors, bookstores, and libraries, are not responsible unless they can be shown to have specific knowledge of the content at issue. Early cases involving interactive computer services supplied this traditional distinction. When the publisher of Scuttlebutt, an electronic newsletter, sued CompuServe for allegedly defamatory statements carried in Rumorville, USA, a competing newsletter, the district court held that CompuServe was a distributor and thus not liable. The court found that CompuServe was, in essence, an electronic for-profit library with little or no editorial control. However, when a securities investment firm and its president sued Prodigy for a message posted on one of Prodigy's electron bulletin boards by an unknown user, they happened to call the president a criminal and accuse the firm of fraud, a different result obtained. Relying on Prodigy's use of human monitors and automated systems to remove objectionable content, the trial judge held that Prodigy was a publisher and thus could be held liable for the defamatory statements. The implication of these early cases was that exercising any editorial control over content posted on site would make the website operator, or ISP, a publisher, and therefore responsible for all the content. This seemed to leave two ways to avoid liability. Website operators and ISPs would either have to exercise editorial control over every line of content posted on their site, or not exercise any control at all. There are two major problems with this result. The first was the obvious chilling effect on the development of new internet and interactive computer services. Anyone wishing to exercise any editorial control would have to implement a system of full editorial control. You know, as soon as you start, you've got to do it all. And you miss one, you're in deep trouble. Okay? Such editorial control would be expensive and time-consuming. It would also require serious limits on the volume of material that could be posted. Without limits, the sheer volume that many services would generate would preclude exercising sufficient editorial control. The second problem was that deterring operators from exercising any editorial control at all would almost certainly increase the amount of objectionable material available. An operator would not remove some objectionable material for fear of then being liable for that which wasn't removed. At that time, the phrase describing this problem was, you edit it, you own it. Congress addressed this problem in Section 230. Now, much of the motivation for this was that Congress was trying to pass the Communications Decency Act, motivated in large part by a Time magazine cover story entitled Cyber Porn. The picture on the cover was a wide-eyed child staring out over a computer keyboard, obviously into a monitor with bad stuff on it. And the article is based on a Georgetown Law Review article by Marty Rim, a Carnegie Mellon undergraduate student. He convinced the Law Review editors and Time not to show the article to others until it was published. Of course, once it was published, social scientists point out his methodology was very seriously flawed. Among other things, Rim had collected his data while consulting with adult bulletin board operators. Not exactly a random sample of the internet. Okay? I guess the moral of this story is don't trust lawyers to evaluate social science research. Time actually had to correct the story, but the damage was done. Many members of the public were convinced the internet was nothing but a repository for porn and that their children were being exposed. However, a big impediment to passing the act was opposition from internet service providers and online service providers who feared they could be found liable under the proposed law. The solution was to provide those companies with immunity. The addition of Section 230 was designed to remove their opposition. As part of it, Congress declared that the internet had, quote, flourished to the benefit of all Americans with a minimum of government regulation, and that it was, quote, the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet and other interactive computer services, unfettered by federal or state regulation. To accomplish that, Section 230 provides, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. Under Section 230, an interactive computer provider or user does not become liable when it exercises traditional editorial functions, such as deciding whether to publish, withdraw, postpone, or alter content. To become liable, the provider or user must either create or develop the content in question. In addition to preventing the specter of tort and/or state criminal liability from chilling internet speech, Section 230 was also intended to encourage operators of interactive computer services to remove at least some objectionable content. You know, as long as you aren't going to get liability for it, maybe you'll be good guys and take some of the bad stuff off. And to develop filtering tools that would help parents prevent their children from accessing objectionable material. Providing immunity, regardless of any exercise of editorial control, was intended to remove the chilling effect of decisions like Stratton-Oakmont. Ideally, this would reduce the amount of objectionable content disseminated via the internet and interactive computer services. Now, of course, one irony is Section 230 is in the Communications Decency Act, but the actual indecency provisions of that act were declared unconstitutional under the First Amendment. So it has survived the indecency part of the act by decades. Okay? Since Section 230 was enacted, courts have continually interpreted interactive computer service broadly. The statute defines interactive computer service as any information service, system, or address access software provider that provides or enables computer access by multiple users to a computer server, including specifically service or system that provides access to the internet and such systems operated or services offered by libraries or educational institutions. Despite arguments that this limited immunity to ISPs and others that provide direct access to the internet, courts have been consistently ruled it includes websites, listservs, social media platforms, and so on. A very expansive reading of that definition. Note that not all objectionable material is covered by Section 230. There's an exception for intellectual property such as copyright, trademark, and patent law. Copyright is covered by a different safe harbor. Unlike Section 230, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act does not provide unconditional immunity for interactive computer services. Instead, immunity can be forfeited for failure to comply with the so-called notice and takedown provisions. In other words, when it's a copyright argument, somebody notifies them you've got copyright infringing material on your site, then you take it down in an expeditious fashion, or you lose your immunity. You now suddenly become liable as well. There are additional notification requirements to ensure that the posting party has an opportunity to contest an assertion of infringement. Trademark law has its own safe harbor, which we don't really need to get into. Now, as you all know, in the 22 years since the passage of the Communications Decency Act, the internet has grown a bit. Many new services not even envisioned at the time of Section 230 was passed have become commonplace. These include video services like YouTube, social networking services like Facebook, shopping services like Amazon. Is there anybody here who has not ever bought anything from Amazon? Didn't think so. Classified ad services like Craigslist, crowdsourced reviews like Yelp, and graphically rich multiplayer games like World of Warcraft. Okay. Access to the internet is now seen as essential as universal telephone service. And in fact, the FCC has changed its whole policy where it used to be focused on making sure everybody had phone service. Now their big focus is on providing broadband to everyone. Okay. Although other factors, including the increased availability of broadband, have also contributed to this increase, there is little doubt that the various safe harbor provisions, including Section 230, have been a major factor in this growth. The Electronic Frontier Foundation calls it the most important law protecting internet speech. Rather strong statement. Without Section 230, it is hard to imagine Yelp even being in business. How many defamatory reviews have you read on Yelp? What if Yelp was liable for all of them? Another one that wouldn't be around probably is ratemyprofessor.com. Although I suspect that argument might be seen by some in the room as an argument against Section 230. However, this has not come without a cost. Individual citizens who have suffered great harm resulting from material posted on the internet have found themselves without recourse, most often because they cannot identify the posters and the operators of a website or electronic bulletin boards are protected by Section 230. An early example of this is a case called Zarin versus America Online. A message was posted on an AOL bulletin board advertising Naughty Oklahoma t-shirts. This was not too long after the Oklahoma City bombing. The shirts featured offensive slogans referring to the bombing. The ad directed people to call Ken at a phone number, which happened to be the home phone number of Kenneth Zarin in Seattle. The person who posted this was never identified. Upon receiving a number of abusive phone calls, including some death threats, Zarin contacted AOL. The ad was eventually removed, although AOL refused a request to have a retraction posted. Subsequently, a number of additional postings similar to the original were placed on the bulletin board, leading to an ever-increasing number of abusive phone calls and death threats. The situation was exacerbated a week later when an announcer for an Oklahoma City radio station read one of these ads over the air and urged listeners to call the phone number in the ad and let him know what they thought of him. It was only after the radio station apologized on air and an Oklahoma City newspaper ran a story about the hoax that the volume of calls decreased. Zarin sued AOL, but lost on the ground that Section 230 provided immunity. He was unable to identify the person or persons who actually posted the hoax ads, leaving him with no remedy at all for the harm he suffered. Okay? Similarly, Christiane Carafano, an actress who used the stage name Chase Masterson and was in the cast of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, found herself without recourse when someone created a fake profile for an online dating service, Matchmaker. The profile for Chase 529 said that she was, quote, looking for a hard and dominant man with a strong sexual appetite, and she liked sort of being controlled by a man, in and out of bed. Emailing an address supplied in the profile triggered an automatic reply containing her home address and phone number. Even though the profile was removed promptly, once Matchmaker, which subsequently changed its name to Metrosplash, was contacted by Carafano's assistant, she received numerous obscene phone calls and letters, as well as a highly threatening and sexually explicit fax that also threatened her son. She sued Metrosplash for defamation, invasion of privacy, and negligence. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit held that the questionnaire provided by Metrosplash merely facilitated the provision of content rather than providing any, and went on to say further that even assuming Matchmaker could be considered an information content provider, the statute precludes treatment as a publisher or speaker for any information provided by another information content provider. The statute would still bar her claims unless Matchmaker created or developed the particular information. Okay, so once again, she can't find out who did it, so it's the paradox. I can identify somebody I can't sue, and I can sue someone I can't identify. Then, I don't know if any of you remember, JuicyCampus.com. The basic purpose of this site was to encourage the anonymous posting of gossip regarding people on different campuses, college campuses. The postings were organized by campus, and readers could reply as well as voting on whether the posting was juicy or not. One could characterize the site as bathroom stall walls applied to the internet. The majority of postings, while not actionable, were indecent and mean-spirited. Some, however, were clearly defamatory, including accusations of rape, sexual deviancy, drug use, and alcoholism. Now note, there's a big difference between Zarin and Carafano on the one hand and services like JuicyCampus.com. Sites like AOL and Metrosplash provided a forum for discussion of other issues, or a service that many found valuable, whereas JuicyCampus existed solely to encourage gossip. In addition, JuicyCampus.com promised total anonymity and provided links to anonymizing services. This emphasis on providing anonymity could only serve to encourage posting objectionable material. In essence, blanket immunity, rather than encouraging some editorial control, often encourages posting of objectionable material. The above examples raise the question of whether the balance between encouraging the development of the internet and protecting individuals' reputations has swung too far in the direction of the former. When I first studied this 10 years ago, most of the egregious examples were in the area of defamation, so I focused on possible revisions in that area. However, the continued growth of the internet and various services has now raised questions in a number of other areas. For example, revenge porn, sex trafficking, trade libel with regard to reviews of services and products, doxing, alleged Russian interference with the last presidential election, terrorism, and even equal opportunity. I don't have time to detail all of these, but I'm sure you're familiar with some of them, such as revenge porn and the controversy regarding the last election. The latter has led Congress to put pressure on services like Facebook and Twitter to address and control the proliferation of foreign government posts intended to influence our elections, and has some people talking about new regulations. However, let me address a couple you may be less familiar with more specifically. For example, one of the controversial sites of the past few years has been Backpage.com, a classified ad site known for its adult section, which contained ads basically for prostitution. In many cases, the prostitutes were in fact victims of human sex trafficking. It was common knowledge that the ads were for these services. And in fact, I was actually a juror in a case a couple of years ago that involved a female victim whose services were advertised on Backpage.com. The charges in the case included one of sex trafficking. In Jane Doe versus Backpage.com, three women who had been trafficked since the age of 15 through ads on Backpage.com sued Backpage.com, alleging that Backpage, with an eye to maximizing its profits, engaged in a course of conduct designed to facilitate sex traffickers' efforts to advertise their victims on the website. This strategy, the said, led to their victimization. Yet Section 230 was held to apply, leading Judge Selya to open his opinion with the following statement. This is a hard case, hard not in the sense that the legal issues defy resolution, but hard in the sense that the law requires that we, like the court below, deny relief to plaintiffs whose circumstances evoke outrage. Most recently, Facebook and others were found to run targeted employment ads. So what is wrong with that? Aren't targeted ads what they do? Well, it becomes a problem when employment ads are only shown to specific age ranges or specific genders. It has long been illegal for newspapers to run ads under headings like Help Wanted Mail. How about not even letting groups see the ad unless they're in that group? Even worse. All of this led to increasing calls to modify or repeal 230. For example, in an editorial in the February 2nd edition of the Boston Globe, responding to this story about the employment ads, the Globe said the following. Facebook largely seems to skate free because it is insistent it is not a media company, but a tech company protected by the powerful Section 230 of the Federal Communications Decency Act, passed in 1996, which holds that websites are not responsible for content posted by users. While Section 230 has allowed internet innovation to flourish to an unprecedented degree, it has also protected Russian trolls, white supremacists, and sex traffickers. But 22 years is an eternity in internet time. In their offline world, consumers have recourse to the court system they buy a faulty product. And job seekers are afforded federal protection against discrimination. Facebook should, at the very least, show it respects the rights of workers. Equal access to jobs is not the only reason that lawmakers should reconsider Section 230. Extending blanket protection to enterprises that act like Gilded Age plutocrats cannot help but stifle the innovators and startups of the future. All in all, that would be bad for people's well-being and for society. The Globe's editorial reflects one of the biggest reasons why attitudes towards protecting internet speech have changed: the sheer size and power of companies like Google and Facebook scare people. And in Europe, these companies have been subjected to numerous legal actions, largely in the area of antitrust and privacy. There are now calls for similar approaches in this country. So who's right? Those who see Section 230 as essential to the continuing development and growth of the internet, or those who say the cost is now too great and the balance between free internet speech and government's right and obligation to protect its citizens from various harms needs to be changed. If Section 230 is to be modified, the first question is whether to craft separate approaches specifically for each type of objectionable content, or a one-size-fits-all that applies to everything. replacing Section 230 with a law governing all internet content, including even copyright trademark. For example, about 10 years ago, Stanford law professor Mark Lemley proposed exactly that. He gave several major reasons why a unified approach would be desirable. Some were specifically aimed at intellectual property, so we won't go into them here. The others were broader. First, he argued that the complexity of multiple safe harbors can confuse intermediaries and lead them to assume they have immunity in situations where they do not. Similarly, confused plaintiffs might file suits when they don't have a legitimate claim. Secondly, he contended that the different protections afforded different content could lead to litigation abuses, with plaintiffs mischaracterizing claims as intellectual property for the express purposes of removing them from Section 230 immunity or the separate treatment afforded trademark claims. Good example of that is you think something's defaming you, but if you can claim it's a copyright infringement, you send your notice and takedown, your notice for takedown. Problem with notice and takedown is most of those companies would rather just take it down than take the risk or fight it. And so you effectively have taken care of the speech, gotten it off when you shouldn't have had any right to. So it is a very good point. And at first blush, the arguments are attractive. However, they fail to take into account three major issues. The first is the distinction between the types of harm that can result from different content. For example, copyright infringing material can cause economic harm to the copyright holder, but is unlikely to cause reputational harm or emotional distress or even physical harm. Defamatory or privacy infringing material obviously can cause reputational and emotional harm. Human sex trafficking material obviously presents still different issues. Similarly, equal opportunity laws and laws directed at election interference all differ in the harm that they are trying to prevent. Second major issue is how different types of content are treated under the First Amendment in terms of both liability and potential remedies. Conflicts between copyright law and the First Amendment are resolved by something called the idea expression of the idea dichotomy, which in simple terms means copyright protects the expression, First Amendment protects the idea. Among other things, this means that an injunction in copyright is treated the same as any other copyright remedy, whereas when applied to other content restrictions, it is considered a prior restraint, which is considered the most egregious First Amendment violation possible and carries a very, very heavy burden of proof in order to sustain it. Okay. As noted above, defamation for many years held to be devoid of First Amendment protection is now protected under the Gertz test. Commercial speech has a lower level of First Amendment protection than political speech. There are even different types of protection for different branches of invasion of privacy. And when you get to indecency law, it depends on the medium of transmission. Broadcast is different than cable, is different than the internet, et cetera, et cetera. So a one-size-fits-all law is going to have a lot of trouble with all those different issues. Final major issue involves the current or potential availability of technological solutions to the problems caused by different forms of objectionable content, specifically filtering technologies. One of the claims made by Viacom in its copyright infringement suit against Google, owner of YouTube, was that Google was using filtering technology to identify and possibly remove copyright infringing material, but only on behalf of those copyright holders who agreed to sign a licensing agreement. Okay. Nevertheless, it indicates another way to address the problem. Similarly, one of the key factors in the various indecency court decisions, the presence of filtering technology. Okay. Doesn't mean that some solutions to the problem might not be appropriate for all objectionable content, but rather that one should not start with the assumption that one size fits all. A couple of possible areas where a broad solution might help. One, doesn't originate with me. A lot of people have had it, but I just would mention it briefly. Namely, limiting anonymity. Okay? one of the biggest problems in Zarin and the others was you're left with nobody to sue. So if you have a limit on that, then you have remedies, and that will help matters. You must take care, however, because anonymous speech is even protected. So you have to put a lot of protections in if you're going to add immunity. Anonymity, or getting rid of it. So you can't just, for example, say, okay, you've all got to find out who they are, right? In other words, a website has to know who's their posters are. You could require them to try and find out. Doesn't mean it'll be perfect, because we all know people can subvert it in different ways. But then the question is, when can somebody else get that identity? And some courts, unfortunately, in defamation, have sort of said, well, as soon as you file the lawsuit. Well, you may be filing a lawsuit to find out who somebody is who posted it, not because you have any legitimate claim, but because you want to find out who they are so you can get them one way or another, right? On the other hand, other courts, and this would be an approach I would more suggest, is you've got to show that you've got a meritorious case. In other words, you've got to sort of show that, but for the identity, you've got a legitimate case of what other type of lawsuit you have filed. And there are courts that have set up tests, New Jersey, the so-called Dendrite four-part test, that would address that. Okay. Now, restricting the ability to post harmful anonymous content would serve two state interests. First, it provides a legal remedy for the victims of the harmful speech. Second, it deters these people from posting. Because let's just say a lot of people will post things if they know they're anonymous, that they won't post if they know they can be identified. And even more so, they won't post if they know could then be sued successfully or even prosecuted criminally or whatever. Now, the reality is even that ability would be limited in terms of undoing the damage. I mean, defamation already has a problem. You sue, you get money. Do you get your reputation back? No. Not only that, but you may not be able to win the suit because of the protections I discussed in Gertz, Sullivan, etc. So you may have been falsely accused of something, and you can prove it, all that, but if you can't prove that they either acted with actual malice, if you're a public figure, or negligence, if you were a private individual. My class is all smiling. We just finished this whole section. You're still out of luck. Not only that, you've now paid a lawyer a lot of money, so you're even more out of luck. However, the second more beneficial aspect is deterrence. Just preventing people from thinking about doing it. The other reason, by the way, that the remedy of damages and being able to sue people doesn't work anymore very well is a dynamic of the internet. Previously, there was at least some correlation between the ability to disseminate widely harmful material and financial resources. Because if you could do that, it usually meant you had a newspaper, a magazine, a book, a broadcast station, whatever. So when you sue them, you can get lots of money, which at least is something. Nowadays, however, with the internet, widespread dissemination is available to almost anybody at negligible cost. Okay? Which means, and by the way, this is the heart of the peer-to-peer copyright cases, that suddenly you could infringe copyright on large scale for very little money and not having to have it. So, even if you can sue these people, you identify them, you sue them, you win. And then you discover that what we call in law judgment proof, which is to say they have no money. So great, you've got a nice piece of paper to put on your wall. See, I won that case against them. That's one reason why sometimes as lawyers we have to advise people don't bother suing. Because, yeah, you could win. In fact, we're sure you're going to win. So you can pay me $50,000 and you can get $10. Cost-benefit analysis says that doesn't work very well. Okay? Now, the other possible change would be to borrow from a 2005 Supreme Court copyright case. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios versus Grokster. Some of you may have heard of it. Basically there, the court borrowed from patent law the concept of inducing infringement. Specifically, they held that one who distributes a device with the object of promoting its use to infringe copyright, as shown by clear expression or other affirmative steps taken to foster infringement, is liable for the resulting acts of infringement by third parties. So in other words, Grokster was essentially inducing other people to infringe copyright. They could be liable. Okay? So I'll give you a case or two where this might really make a difference. Jones versus Dirty World. Dirty World was a site where users submitted anonymous content. Nick Ritchie, who managed the site, would select 150 to 200 items each day to appear, all attributed to the Dirty Army. One such item stated that Sarah Jones, a Cincinnati Bengals cheerleader and public school teacher, had slept with the entire team. Jones requested the item be removed. He refused, then posted more items, including the following. Here we have Sarah J., captain cheerleader of the playoff-bound Cincy Bengals. But what most of you don't know is her ex, Nate, cheated on her with over 50 girls in 4 years, and in that time has tested positive for chlamydia and gonorrhea. So I'm sure Sarah also has both. He then added the following comment below the post. Why are all high school teachers freaks in the sack? Real high-class site. District court, probably motivated by the outrage similar to that referenced by Judge Selya in the Backpage.com case, rejected an immunity claim under Section 230, holding that a website owner who intentionally encourages illegal or actionable third-party postings to which he adds his own comments, ratifying or adopting the post, becomes a creator or developer and is not entitled to immunity. Unfortunately, the Sixth Circuit reversed, holding that Section 230 did apply, using a material contribution test. Develop means one actually contributes to the illegality of the content. Okay. So for example, if I posted something that said, John Jones is not a thief, and you edit out the word not, you now have developed that content and you're liable. But here, there was nothing that overt. And therefore, under material contribution, you don't get anything, okay? Similarly, in Jane Doe Backpage, which we've already talked about, the plaintiffs described choices Backpage had made about the posting standards for advertisements. For example, rules about which terms are permitted or not permitted in a posting, the lack of controls on the display of phone numbers, the option to anonymize email addresses, the stripping of metadata from photographs uploaded to the website, the website's reaction after a forbidden term is entered into an advertisement, and Backpage's acceptance of anonymous payments. Their lawyers argued this constituted developing the content. But as we know, the First Circuit rejected that claim, claiming that was too broad an interpretation of develop. Note that in both cases, adding an inducement exception would almost certainly have reversed the result. In other words, it's almost taking the definition the district court tried to use, but putting a word in the statute that actually means the definition he was using. Okay. Note that the choices Backpage made all clearly increased the likelihood this content would be posted and in turn led to greater income. In fact, they expanded their section when Craigslist shut down their adult section. the same time, induce would be much harder to argue in cases like against Facebook, Twitter, or those. They clearly don't fall into that category. What if instead exceptions are added that apply only to specific areas? So I'm just going to look quickly at one. Congress, in direct response to cases like Jane Doe, is considering changing the application of Section 230 to sex trafficking. The Senate version of the bill is called Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act of 2017, or SESTA. So if you see that acronym now, you know what it means. The key provision of the bill would remove immunity for a company that knowingly assists, supports, or facilitates human sex trafficking. This bill illustrates a key problem with revising Section 230. Anybody want to define knowingly assists, supports, or facilitates? What exactly does it mean? It would probably lead to a huge increase in lawsuits against all kinds of websites, social media, etc. If applied beyond sex trafficking, as some people would like, it would have a huge chilling effect. For example, Twitter has been sued on several occasions for aiding terrorism. One case involving a claim that Facebook should be held liable for, this was Facebook case and then the Twitter case, held liable for allowing Hamas to use its platform to encourage terrorist attacks. In another, the claim was that Twitter should be held liable for providing ISIS an account to use for spreading extremist propaganda. How would those cases have turned out if the standard was knowingly assists, supports, or facilitates? These definitional problems are the problem with any specific exceptions to Section 230, both in terms of defining the content that is covered by the exception and the exact level of knowledge of the content. For example, can you imagine if a restriction on fake news were put into the law? One person's fake news is another person's truth. Would you want government officials deciding what is and what isn't fake news? No, I don't think I'd be very comfortable with it. For those of you who don't believe defining terms in law is that hard, by the way, I suggest you look up a recent case in Maine where the lack of an Oxford comma cost a company $5 million. Literally. They had to interpret a statute, and the court decided because it was a missing Oxford comma that it meant something different than what I think the legislature clearly intended. Okay. Yet there's a good chance that one or more will be passed due to the outrage caused by various cases I've discussed. Can you really imagine elected officials publicly opposing a law that stated purpose of which is to reduce sex trafficking? Yeah, that opposition there is going to get a lot of votes, right? If you want to get elected again. And there is a lot of support for SESTA. In addition, as mentioned earlier, the public's attitude towards the large internet companies, or Gilded Age plutocrats, as the Globe called them, has changed. Not many of you Google as the nice, helpful, do-no-harm company it once was. The decision to revise Section 230 ultimately depends on where you think the balance between internet freedom and protecting people from harmful speech should be. There's no way to perfectly serve both interests. Depending on which side you're coming from, the question becomes, how much internet freedom are you willing to sacrifice to protect people from harm? Or in the alternative, how many people will you allow to be harmed to protect internet freedom? Because I can promise you, there is no way to totally serve both interests. So it will be a very interesting next few years as they go forward on Section 230. Thank you. Questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Professor, for that very erudite and learned presentation. I was wondering if you would like to speculate about the future a little bit. And you've done a wonderful job of summarizing the evolution
I think that right now we have an interesting confluence of events, the election, the back page issue, and you have a lot of people who now, and even look at the Globe, right? Liberal bastion, Boston Globe, and they're calling for getting rid of 230 or drastically altering it. The other side of the coin is, let's face it right now, Congress is not exactly the most functional body on planet. So whether they can actually get legislation through will be a very interesting problem. The secondary issue I think that will happen then is when they start to put exceptions in, if they do, will they meet tests for vagueness, for example? Or will courts look at them and say, wait a minute, we don't know what this phrase is, and that's going to chill too much speech, so it's void for vagueness. It's a very turbulent time in this area. Support of the First Amendment has dropped in this country in many ways, especially on campuses. All kinds of proposals are, you can't speak unless you say the right things. I mean, we see many stories. If you want to see a lot of stuff on that, there's a group called FIRE, Foundation for Individual Rights, I think is the start of it. But their basic issue is First Amendment protections on campuses. The E is education. And they're totaling up much larger number of what they see as violations. So as you become more tolerant of restrictions on speech, you become more horrified by the bad examples. I'd like to think I'm wrong, but I think the likelihood is increasing. And the next few years will prove very interesting in that area. Looks like a good chance system or some variation will pass, for example. There are a lot of people who believe it's got the legs. Because it's a bipartisan issue that everybody can get behind, right? Who's going to stand up and say, well, I am for sex trafficking, right? And that's what happens. Things get simplified. Because let's face it, let's say you vote against it. Next election, your opponent comes out and says, can you see what this person, he wouldn't protect people from sex trafficking. Do you take that risk? In fact, I've seen a story that the major internet companies have decided not to oppose SESTA, probably figuring it's less likely to affect them per se, and they've got enough problems. And people are going after them for all kinds of other things. So here's one we can sort of, you know, throw them a bone and stay out of it. Is that? Yeah.
To what extent could you imagine online pornography being scooped up into sex trafficking? In that we have no way of knowing if these women are being coerced or the men are being coerced.
That's a different issue. I think they have to have something more than, well, they could be. I mean, hypothetically. I mean, these cases are about people who knowingly assisted. It's like when they started doing things on child pornography. And they eventually, the court said that, yes, you could limit child films with child pornography, but you couldn't do it where they were computer graphics that they were just created. You couldn't sue if there were adults who happened to look like children. But you could sue, or you could prosecute, if they took a child's head and put it on an adult body in one of these. So the courts are going to parse that out. I think you don't have enough of a connection. Well, we don't know if, but we also don't know, you know, if they weren't. And usually the burden of proof is a little stronger than, well, they could be.
Been used to deal with a lot of these cases you've talked about, people who are being maligned by misinformation, because it's widely used in, I understand, in Europe.
First of all, the right to be, this is one of these interesting things. The right to be forgotten is a misnomer. It's really the right to be delinked. It's a data information law. So it doesn't mean that newspapers have to take stuff down, et cetera. It means that Google has to take searches, eliminate those links from their searches. And that's just in Europe. And so a few other countries have now also adopted it, but not the US. So they haven't on any of these cases. Doing in this country provides this very different barrier too, which is the First Amendment. There are lots of restrictions on speech that are fine in Europe. Hate speech, for example, that don't fly in this country. So at the moment, I would say, at least in this country, that's probably not going to have a major effect. Yeah?
I have a question about what you think in terms of the technology advancing way beyond the law. For the advancements in digital video editing, where you can now put people's heads, you were at
right.
Pornography, made me think of this, where you can put people's heads onto like porn star apps.
Ah, yes. And the fact is, now there's a little program out there that anybody could do it for almost no money. I think it well,
but
first,
if this pushes because it's so extreme in terms of
I think it would probably be defamation, no question.
Yeah.
Probably false light too. Actually, certainly false light in states that recognize it. But I don't think that's going to be a separate Section 230
right.
issue per se. I do think it's just another area where technology is causing lots of legal problems.
Yeah. Do you think it would be the technology that enables the creation of that kind of thing versus the so public distributors?
No, I don't think that people who make the program could be, because it could be used for a lot of non harmful uses. So unless they're promoting it by saying, hey, make sure you put somebody's head on a porn star, they're probably not going to be liable. That's the difference between just providing, it's like in copyright, you don't sue Xerox because somebody copied a book on their machine.
Is it a possibility, or do you see it being a possibility that if this is not something that the federal government through Congress is not willing or able to address, could this be something that states address individually?
No, because Section 230 specifically prohibits state, immunity from state regulation. So unless Section 230 is modified, a lot of these actions were actually state law actions. But the state can't, the supremacy clause, they can't override the federal statute. Yeah?
So you talk about the differences in different countries, but we know a lot of those platforms are international. So how that complicate the problem?
Oh. The internet complicates jurisdiction beyond belief. And in fact, all right, I'll give you an example why it's the difficulties of it. Let's take the right to be forgotten. And let's take Google. And Google France, Google in France, the French country. That's okay. As I was saying about France, they were to take something down or de-link something. So they de-linked it from Google France. And the French court said, that's no good because people will just go to Google and look at it. So they insisted that Google has to take it down from all their platforms, which now raises a very, very interesting question, because now the French are essentially dictating what we can watch or see. And that's still playing out. But there are going to be a lot more of those. Those will probably have to be settled more by treaty than anything. Another case, actually, Tuesday, Supreme Court is hearing a case involving Microsoft. And the question of whether or not material that they have stored on a server in Ireland, whether a US court can insist on having that material. In other words, they subpoena the material from Microsoft, and Microsoft says, well, this stuff's not in your jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court will be hearing arguments Tuesday on which way that should go. But yeah, jurisdictional issues with the internet are a nightmare of a whole nother dimension. Because of course, how do you know where it originated? At the same time, the other side of that coin is it makes enforcement of a lot of stuff almost impossible. For example, we have something called the CAN Spam Act. Believe it or not, that's a US statute, which is to limit spam. So I noticed none of us have been getting any spam lately, right? Why do you think that isn't that effective?
Anonymous?
No, I can post who I am. And if I'm doing it from Czechoslovakia, the law doesn't apply to me. It's a US law. So how do you get jurisdiction? In fact, you may note the timing of a lot of your spam tends to coincide with daytime in either Asia or Eastern Europe. Okay? So unless countries are willing to cooperate more, but the problem in the information era is that we don't all have the same view of freedom of speech and what should be protected and what shouldn't. In fact, another quick law, the Libel Tourism Act, another great name. Libel Tourism Act was based on the fact that people would go sue for libel in other countries for stuff that was on the internet, get a judgment, they come over here and ask the US courts to enforce it. So we passed a law that says, if you couldn't have gotten the judgment here, we won't enforce it. So if Section 230 for the First Amendment, Sullivan, Gertz, et cetera, would have precluded a judgment, you've got a worthless piece of paper. But that again illustrates the problem. Any other questions? Yeah.
I had one quick question, going back to the nature of the slippery definitions.
Yeah.
What is facilitation, for instance? So we focused on the idea of the creation or development of content. And I'm wondering, does content only ever mean message within a channel, or can it also relate to the parameters of the creation? So a tweet, by definition, did not exist before Twitter.
Right.
And the limitation of 140 characters did not exist before then. Is there any, I can type whatever I want within those characters.
Right.
Is that where the buck stops? Or is there any aspect of content that relates to the parameters set up?
No, some people have actually argued that you need a change in defamation and other things because 140 characters doesn't allow for nuance.
Right.
But so far nobody's been able to convince anybody of that. So even though there have been defamation cases with Twitter, or what we call twibble, libelous tweets. And by the way, the first case of twibble that got through the courts involved Courtney Love. I'll leave it at that. Okay, so no, they haven't taken that as too part of creation. That's a material contribution test.
Okay.
So you have to materially contribute to the harmful content.